This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
It's 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. My name's Jacob.
Well, I must be Mercedes then. And we're on Community Radio 3CR with Friday Rave. Yep, you're with Community Radio 3CR, broadcasted to you at 855 on your old school AM dial, through 3CR Digital via your favourite podcast client, through all the W's at 3cr.org.au, or via your secret surveillance helicopter in the sky. However you're listed, I hope, like me, you're glad to see some sun finally coming out over the city of Melbourne. I tell you what, I've been waiting for it. It seems since I got back from my little sojourn on the road, it's been raining just about every day I've been back. But now we're in Melbourne in the springtime, and all is right with the world. My name's Jacob, and this is Mercedes.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another week. Before we get into it, today down at the US consulate, there was a rally led by the Latin America Solidarity Network, obviously with warships on their way to Venezuela at the moment. Encourage everyone to jump on LASNET's social medias and Facebooks and Instagrams and follow what they're doing and for information on that. Also ongoing is the Golgotha fight for protection of country against rocket launches by Southern Launch. And, you know, that is ongoing. And so make sure to keep on following and getting information. There's more information about the Department of Defense contracts that are coming out. And that's at West Mallee Protection on Instagram. So make sure to jump on there and keep updated about what's going on there. So big shout out to those groups and everyone else still coming out on the streets.
Absolutely. Now, we were off last week because I think we were both crook. I know you couldn't make it at 5, and I was just too cooked to do the pre-record. So apologies, and hope that the special we had on Hiroshima Day was good enough for you for a week. But today we're going full Friday rave. And without further ado, full Friday rave. You've all heard about it this week. The coup. What's being called the 50th anniversary of the dismissal of the Labor Party government led by Gough Whitlam. And most of what's been coming across in the media, this is what we want to talk about, what's been coming across in the media has been reporting on the shameful episode as if it were an historical anomaly, an aberration. And it isn't, you know that, you know. But before I go any further, while we're happy to slag the mainstream media about their coverage and about most things, I want to urge you all to spend a couple of hours reading the articles on John Menadue's website, Pearls and Irritations, to get your head around all the various machinations of power that conspired to overthrow a democratically elected government. Really, we're not going to go into all of it in a half-hour program. The information about what went down is out there, and I can't see any point in continuing to push the case that this was, in fact, a coup orchestrated by global capital against the people. And what is more important to understand is that it's not an historical anomaly. It's the way things actually work and continue to work. To understand that the coup in Australia did not take place in a vacuum and was directly influenced by international events. Things like the US losing the war in Vietnam, the UK joining the EEC, the 73 Israel War, the Yom Kippur War, whatever you want to call it, and its aftermath, of course, the 1974 oil crisis.
Yeah, that's right. And in the lead up to the 1974 oil crisis, I think it was, in October that year?
Yep.
Just prior to that, September 11th of 1973, Gough Whitlam had September 11th is another important date we'll get to later, but had a press conference and was talking about sending a representative from the Trade Commission to the Middle East in Beirut to establish relationships in regards to petroleum imports to Australia, as it's one of the biggest industries in imports at the time. And that was in 73, just prior to the oil crisis.
Just prior to OPEC calling the embargo.
Yeah.
And, you know, so while it's tempting to look at the sacking of the Labor government as a kind of homegrown insulated political event triggered by a hostile Senate blocking appropriation bills, because... And I say it's tempting because, above everything else, it implies, in a strange way, that our democratic system works. I mean, sure, obviously it didn't. But the feeling is, and the main narrative is, we've sorted that out.
Mm.
More to the point, though, it's tempting to believe it was an aberration in the political system brought about by local factors, which is largely the mainstream take on it, even while hinting at the foreign interference beyond the obvious role of the Crown, because it allows you to believe that our democratic system today is working. And let me tell you, even some of the most diehard lefties fall for this. The belief that if we change this or that law, if we elect this or that politician, we can change things and make the country the kind of fair and egalitarian place we'd like it to be, where we can do things like stop making weapons for genocide, for example. And we want to believe this because we, particularly those of us who have grown up in this country, have at the core of our belief system, regardless of politics or social ideology, an almost existential, intrinsic belief that our political opinions matter. That is, by participating in the process, whether it be through rallies, meetings, leaflets or voting or whatever, that we can enact change. So we got this weird situation. So... Well, at the same time, we know that we really don't live under a democratic system at all. We act as if we do and go through the motions because to do otherwise would to be admit that we had no agency.
Mm.
And this has led to a collective cognitive dissonance on the left, which sees us indulge in all kinds of codependent, self-affirming rituals. And
yeah.
Expectations.
And rituals is a good way to put it. And I think, you know, when you think about what an election cycle does, it's like it instills or foments a belief that, well, we can change things. And as we're talking about here, the shifts in local factors of the mainstream narrative to say, oh, it's because there are things that change, but on a local scale, but without an understanding of the global machinations that are in play, which a lot of us on the left have, but yet when we still engage in these... in these processes, it reinforces that the belief that those machinations aren't actually at play.
Yeah.
Because we want to believe that, maybe.
Yeah, and it's, as I say, a cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
That's the only way to describe it. And we've gone off topic here, because I want to talk about the 50th anniversary. But before we get to it, I've got to say, just saying what I just said makes me realise that I can already hear people thinking I'm a hypocrite because I do all those things, the stalls, the rallies, the speeches, the marches, whatever. And I do it.
The radio show.
But not because I think it will sway government opinion to the point where we'll see real change. All I ever want to do is point out what's really happening. I don't think any listener can come back to me with an example, at least not in the last 30 or 40 years, where I've said, I call on the government to do this. All I want to do is expose what's really happening. And I do recognise that through public action we can tweak the excesses of things on the ground, we can save a forest or a river here or there, provide marginally better services for the most oppressed amongst us, usually at the expense of other oppressed people and less marginal electorates. I'm not saying there's no need and we can have no change. But really, what I wanted to say about the anniversary of the coup is that it wasn't an aberration, but rather a foundational moment in the way our system of government works in the world. And that's not the coup itself necessarily, that's important, but more germane, I think, to the work we do on the left, is the point where the broader Australian left, such as the ALP, and a large part of the trade union movement, have decided that they just wear it. Go home, vote to them at the next election. A key figure, of course, was Bob Hawke, who immediately took the position that the sacking of the government should not be escalated, saying he didn't want blood on the streets.
Bob Hawke the peacenik.
Good Lord. Cable's released by WikiLeaks almost 40 years later, the embassy files, the cable game, from the US embassy, praised Hawke's role in controlling the anger of workers after the coup through his role as ACTU president. You know, because he was in the pockets of the Yanks, he always was, right until the day he died. But inciting blood in the streets, saying, calm down, that was the un-Australian way he was telling people. You know, and there might have been blood in the streets, and maybe there should have been. When your democratically elected leader is overthrown, how many people with a left-wing bone in their body would argue the fact that the people shouldn't have taken to the streets and rioted? And, you know, as Henry Lawson pointed out 80 years earlier, they needn't say the fault of ours, blood should stain the wattle. But we didn't. We went back to our homes. We went back to work. There were thousands of people out front of Parliament House that day. I was just a young bloke and I went down from Sydney. And people were ready to do things. But anyway, the government, it's rightly been lauded, I've got to say. To move on to another aspect of it, they've been lauded for some of the practical impacts they've made on ordinary Australian lives, though far from perfect. Things like Medicare, access to tertiary education, land rights, no-fault divorce and the rest. But more important than any of these is that their willingness to take a political line against global capital, both home and abroad. And I know it sounds awkward referring to the AOP government, but I do this in deference to an old mate who's no longer with us, Moss Cass, who once took me aside after a talk I gave and chided me for referring to the Whitlam government, emphasising that it was actually an ALP government of which he was a member. The ALP government, with Whitlam as its figurehead, openly condemned the US bombing of Vietnam. Openly condemned it. And let's not forget that, you know, a late change in life, post-politic pension, Malcolm Fraser notwithstanding, he was the defence minister for a big part of Australia's involvement in that war.
Mm. And wasn't it the condemnation of the bombing in Vietnam, in the US, they were saying that Australia and Whitlam, as its figurehead, was essentially there were North Vietnam co-conspirators.
Exactly.
As a result of...
Treat them like the Viet Cong.
Yeah.
That's what they said. You know, the Whitlam government, the ALP government, had that principal position. They also opposed US arms sales to Israel's. And Fraser was also the Minister of Defence when they started Pine Gap.
Mm.
All right? And Whitlam threatened to not renew the leases on Pine Gap, Narangarra and Northwest Cape. And in recent times, the ALP government has not only fully supported these installations, though Narunga's role has been subsumed by Pine Gap, but increased the level of the US's military presence at a rate that the Tories would never get away with.
Yeah. And what if listeners go and read on Pearls and Irritations or anything, Pine Gap is mentioned a lot, and I think it would be remiss not to mention that the lease was, there was a forthcoming lease renewal
in December.
In that December that was coming up. And, you know, that's kind of is the narrative, which then has now existed since that lease renewal.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Of that year.
But, you know, as I say, Whitlam attacked Nixon for the bombing. And while that happens, we have the, just as an aside, we've got the person pretending to fill his boots. He's not man enough to fill one of his socks, quite frankly. Albanese calls Trump a friend and almost rolled on his back and wet himself in subservience during a recent trip to the White House. And, of course, he went and tugged his forelock to King Charles, who, as Prince Charles, was the Queen's point man during the 75 coup. Mm. And no one's mentioning that while the 50th anniversary remembrance had taken place, Princess Royal, whatever fucking...
Oh, don't look at me, I've got no idea.
...is in Melbourne inspecting the troops as part of her role as some kind of military commander of some of the troops that are here in Melbourne.
What?
Yeah, Princess Anne is here, flying the colours, inspecting her troops. All right, 50 years to the day.
Oh,
and no doubt Albanese and Richard Miles and Penny Wong and all the rest of the lick-spittle puppy fiddlers are wetting themselves to shake her hand and raise a cup of tea and crook their little finger with her. But anyway,
also, sorry, back to September 11, also at the time, Gough Whitlam, when they learnt that ASIS had offices in Chile as a CIA front to orchestrate the overthrow of Allende, Whitlam at the time called them back. And it is important to mention, and I'm going to bring this up again a little bit later, but that some of those ASIS officers refused to come home. So they refused a direct order from the Australian government in order to continue their work alongside the CIA.
In the overthrow of Allende.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. And what some other younger listeners and younger co-hosts may not be aware of, because it's often left out of the discourse, excuse me, is the government's pledge at the time, then one of their major policies was to buy back the farm.
Mm.
And by that, they were talking about nationalising mineral rights. All right, they continued with this objective even through after the oil crisis hit in AB 74. Following OPEC's anger at Western countries' support of arms supply to Israel, in the 73 Yom Kippur War. Indeed, they saw the impact of the oil crisis as even further justification of the need to control our own minerals and oil industry. And this oil crisis led to a huge downturn in the Australian economy due to the foreign control of industry, which they were trying to get rid of, and this was a trigger that was used to stop the appropriations bill in the Senate. What's become known as blocking supply in the Australian political lexicon, but is identical to what in the US is called government shutdown, which we've been witnessing over there for the last 6 weeks. That's what they were pulling. And, you know, they're only able to block supply as well because I forget his name now, but a Labor senator from Queensland died and he was replaced by Bjelke Joe, who apparently was spoken to by Marshall Green, who I'll get on to, the US ambassador, and told to put a Labor Party delegate friendly to American interests in his place. And that's how they had the numbers in the Senate. All right. Anyway, just talked about that. We saw the collusion of so many players. I mean, I just mentioned Marshall Green was made ambassador. He's a coup master who oversaw the overthrow of the Sukarno government in Indonesia, along with the murder of 500,000 communists on a list he supplied, who Harold Holt said was a good thing when we got news that 500,000 people were butchered. He called it a good thing and in our favour. And, you know, it's security agency. We're getting the security agencies. By nature, they're very secretive and good at their craft, so it's almost impossible to know exactly what roles they played in every aspect of the forces' raids against the government, at least to a point that would be required in court as absolute proof. But there are too many coincidences and allegations of collusion to go into from the start to come to any conclusion other than the security establishment, nowadays known as the Five Eyes Network in the US, UK and Australia, all conspired to bring down the elected ALP government. And I believe, mate, that you might have something to say about how that was actually where that goes back to.
Well, yeah, and so another thing is that Whitlam, the ALP government under Whitlam's leadership, also was looking at investigating ASIO and the role of ASIO. Mm. So this follows the withdrawal of people from ASIS.
Yep.
And I think it is, you know, we're talking here not just about particular local factors, but also it's not an aberration and a continuation of the relationship of how that works. And I guess just going back to the formation of ASIO and the precursors to the formation of ASIO from 1947.
Yep.
And so it was alleged that in the US that there'd been a breach of security from Australia, and that there was information getting passed to the Soviet embassy in Canberra around 1947. Yep. And so in response, the US classified all defence and foreign policy information and put an embargo on sharing anything in Australia. And yeah. So by there was an appeal to have the embargo lifted in May of 1948. And I'm just going to read a little quote from that appeal from the meeting at the Pentagon in relation to it. If we've got time, I'll do it quick. The bulletin responding in August 1948 to the United States information ban makes clear its view of the Australian Labor government. Because of political immaturity, a leftish government greatly influenced by communistic infiltrated labour organisations, and the fact that Australian governmental activities have violated the basic security principle that classified information should not be divulged to unauthorised persons, Australia is a poor security risk. And so they continued the embargo after that meeting in 1948. And by March of 1949, the government responded to to answer the accusation and to respond was to develop and form the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation to rationalise, professionalise and cement Australia as a trusted source to work with the US.
Exactly.
And so ASIO was created off the back of assumed
distrust in a future communist-inspired Labor Party government.
Yep. There you go.
That's
and so ASIO was formed to go, hey, no, actually, no, we're on your side. We'll do it. Yeah. That's the and so as soon, you know, Whitlam and the ALP government at the time, not all of them, but
yeah.
The left faction, were pushing to have ASIO investigated at the time.
Well, and Lionel Murphy raided the ASIO offices because he was concerned that they were holding information, and particularly about the war that was going on in Sydney all around me as a kid between the Crows and the Serbs.
Yep.
And ASIO, of course, the right, were supporting the Ustasha.
Mm-hmm.
And they were attacking communists.
Yeah.
And this is and Lionel Murphy raided the officers. But it's hard. But, you know, following the coup, a number of things happened that shaped the country we live in. Prime Minister Fraser extended the leases of the US base at Pine Gap and offered the US new berthing facilities in Western Australia. And there's never been any serious political discussion on closing the bases since. Indeed, since 1975, the US military and the UK military, the footprint in Australia has grown and grown and grown, and alongside it, the footprint of the global capital based in the US, to the point that now 17 of the top 20 companies on the Australian Stock Exchange are controlled by US-based global capital. And the next thing that happened was that Fraser increased, almost doubled, back to ASIO, the ASIO budget and powers. And then the next thing you know, a couple of years go by and they orchestrate the bungled Hilton Hotel bombing that puts and pin it on the Anand Damaga and Tim Anderson and two mates, which not only then gave ASIO more money and sweeping new powers, but kickstarted the concept in Australia. I know it's been going on longer in Europe and the US, but it kickstarted the concept in Australia of the security state that is led inexorably, step by step, to the point where, you know, I remember the first dozen years after 9/11, Australia passed more anti-terrorist bills than any other country, and keep going. And we're still passing them.
And we're still passing them. And the extension of that, I can't remember her name, but the new commissioner of the AFP in a National Press Club address just a couple of weeks ago, saying that now the AFP is the Australian Federal Police is operating in 30 countries and is now a national security organisation.
That's right.
Working alongside Five Eyes.
The AFP. And they're raising and they're raiding my friends on the Northern Rivers for their involvement in Palestine protests. But that's a whole other issue.
But we digress.
Yeah.
Again.
Again. So, and here's the final point I want to make in a few minutes. We've got, it's tempting. It's all too tempting and too easy to take all this information about what we know about Marshall Green and about the CIA involvement and all the rest of it and to pin it all on the US government. And that's how I grew up in politics, was pinning it all on the US government. But you need to remember, and this is a very, very important point, and if you take nothing away from this radio show, take this away, that at the time of the Whitlam Prime Ministership and the destabilisation of the government took place while Richard Nixon was president, and he was in the process of being disgraced over Watergate. And the actual coup happened while Gerry Ford was president. Now, while he was vice president, Ford was all over the US working with major financiers in the project to implement the Powell Memorandum, the blueprint to implement global capital's agenda through the mechanisms of official government. starting with the Federalist Society, setting up organisations we now call think tanks and super PAC mobs, like the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation, and a network of smaller organisations in their progeny, you know, in Australia, ASPE and the IPA. And so many of the Liberal Party, what's the word, members have come through the IPA.
Yeah, well, and I think it's good to mention, as we mentioned on the radio show, you know, with the cut of the funding to USAID at the start of the Trump administration, you know, seeing how much of the funding of those think tanks was...
Dried up. Yeah.
Yeah.
To the point where all the anti-government newspapers in left-wing countries all over the world had to close down. I thought it was a bloody great thing. You know, Mercedes, you've been documenting the way these think tanks and PR firms influence the government, particularly in areas of weapons and critical minerals, and we'll go into that on another week. We've only got a couple of minutes left. But I know this all starts to sound like some kind of cooker conspiracy. You know, I mean, really, it does, doesn't it? And this is an appropriate time to announce that over the summer season, a Friday rave will be broadcasting a number of hour-long specials as backgrounders into some of the issues you regularly raise, and the rise and influence of think tanks and PR firms stemming from Gerry Ford's movements in the 70s is going to be first amongst them.
Yeah, absolutely. And just on that, so that's going to be over the summer. And all of those things that we say we're going to talk about and we want to get to, this is going to, you know.
Yeah, we've just before we came on here, we got approval to do a number. We haven't got the actual number yet, but I hope before 4 or 5, 1-hour-long shows in addition to a Friday rave to fill the time that the radio is closed for the first few weeks in January. So we're going to be doing that. We'll
so
let
more
you know
on think tanks to come.
Closer to the day. But I just wanted to say that to recognise the issues we started with, the lack of actual democracy in the democratic system is not an entirely Australian phenomenon. The US government is beholden to the same network of global capital that the Australian one is and suffers the same problems on the left of cognitive dissonance that we do, which is why we simultaneously are happy about the mayoral election in New York while not actually believing that will change anything.
Well, I mean, a line of mine is that elections are the highest form of counterinsurgency, but, you know.
Absolutely. The idea that their current problems are about Trump, I mean, sure, Trump is a fuckwit, but he's not the problem. Neither Albanese or Starmer are the problems. It's the global capital. Well, they are the problems. They're the problems because they provide a diversionary focal point for our opposition rather than actually directing our wrath, our anger at the powers behind these thrones.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get on to more of that
in the
weeks to come.
They're like the screw in the bottom of the boot that's on your neck.
Exactly. Or the pimple on the knuckle and the middle finger of my left hand right now.
Oh.
Mosquito bite.
Oh. Yeah. Far out. Well, that's about all we've got time for this week. We'll be back at you on a Friday rave next week. We'll figure out something to talk about between now and then.
Something might even happen. We might talk about Venezuela.
Yeah.
If there still is a Venezuela.
It's necessary. But keep it locked for Radio MMT. You're tuned to Community Radio 3CR. And we will catch you more next week. Oh, and also just before we do go off air, next Thursday, the 20th November, is the Beyond the Bars CD launch at the Dewey Centre. So there will be a CSA for some info. So make sure to get along to that.
Yep.
And support the program in its 24th year now.
Do you know where it is?
It's at the Jury Centre, just off Punt Row, Old Holly Street.
Same place it was last week.
Yeah.
Last year.
That's right. All right, keep it locked. You're tuned to Community Radio 3CR. Enough from us.
Enough from me.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.